And take one. Welcome, my name is Rick Timmis.
I'm John Wordsworth.
And I, of course, am Jackson Matthews. On tonight's show, we'll be looking at the love affair between Nokia and Windows 7 Mobile, Adobe's new work on a Flash to HTML5 converter, then we've got a trio of beautiful little apps, some fun stuff in our review section. We'll be looking at installing Android x86 2.2 in VirtualBox. And finally, in our deep thought section, we'll be looking at the CUDA Computing Showcase. Looking at some graphics and 3D modelling, that kind of thing.
Sounds cool.
Cool. So here we are for episode 3 of At Random.
Yeah, so this month in brief, a couple of things to look at this month. Wanted to talk about something that's a little bit of gossip, actually, chaps. I noticed just recently that Nokia have dropped the development that they were putting into the Mego system on their handsets. They'd been developing an open source technology based on Qt to put an operating system called Mego on all of their phones and handsets. And they've dropped that in favour of Windows Mobile 7. They are going to continue doing some of the Mego platform development, but they're effectively selling off Qt. It's been sold to a Finnish company, and they're effectively having no more to do really with the open source platform, and they're placing all of their bets with Microsoft going forward on the new Nokia platform. Strategically, that may well make sense for them. The point that I found really, really interesting here is that in recent times, Nokia appointed a new chief operations officer. And it's that guy who has spearheaded the strategic changes at Nokia to do away with the Qt platform and to move to Windows Mobile. Now, it's very interesting, this, because way back a few years ago, I was actually chief exec of the Open Source Consortium here in the UK. And we tackled the BBC over its platform lock-in on the iPlayer. The BBC had basically been working on a technology called Dirac to stream BBC content over the internet to many different platforms. They changed that strategy in favour of just producing something that was Windows Media-based on the Windows XP platform.
Never a good idea.
No. Well, you know, that was sort of doomed to failure. But we brought them to task under EU law, anti-illegal state aid legislation. What was interesting about that was that for the most part, they'd been working on their own technology, and then they got appointed a new strategic director, head of future media, a gentleman called Eric Huggers. Now, Eric took over the project.
That's a lovely name.
I know it is, isn't it? Eric Huggers. And it's a German name, because Eric with a K, Eric Huggers. And so his job was to develop future media. And what happened was he immediately ceased the Dirac development and went for Windows Media. What was really interesting about Eric was that his previous career before joining the BBC, he was 10 years working on the board as an executive at Microsoft.
Oh. Sleeper agents that Microsoft have all around the world, it seems.
Yeah, well, far be it from me to say, but what I can tell you is that the chief operations officer, strategic responsibility for Nokia, his previous job was as an executive board member of Microsoft Corporation. Make of that what you will, but these are not the only examples of people who have effectively orchestrated significant strategic changes at big chip corporate level. And interestingly, you know, they resigned recently or moved on from Microsoft to take those positions. Make of that what you will, but I found it really interesting. I
wonder if they still have shares in Microsoft. That's quite an interesting.
Well, there was a big payout for this. Nokia were paid in excess of an undisclosed sum, as I understand it, but in excess of $1 billion to take this deal. So it was a bit of a sweetener for them.
I actually think it's a really good move for both companies and the marketplace as a whole. Because we were considering, you know, like the platform of Windows 7 as a viable development platform.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think, up before this point, I never saw it as getting that massive a foothold. But now it's going to get an automatic foothold from the Nokia fan base, mm-hmm. which means that actually I think we're going to see a lot more Windows 7 handsets in the coming couple of years than we would have seen otherwise. And that will make Windows 7 a better development platform, which will earn Microsoft more money. Mm-hmm. It will keep Nokia in the game. And I think it's the perfect corner to the trio between the open source, completely open platform of Android, the locked down iOS, and Microsoft. It's just sitting somewhere in the middle, kind of, you can develop what you like, but it's not open source, which means that we've got some control over it, so we're not going to get loads of viruses and rubbish on our app store.
Well, you will, because it's Windows. It's going to be full of viruses.
But, you know, to the extent that the Google Marketplace, you get loads of apps and they're a bit bitty and some don't work, they'll lock that down.
Yeah.
But not to the extent of Apple, where you lose control over the device. So.
I don't know
what you think, Jeff.
Well, I think more competition is always got to be a good thing, so long as they're not actively hurting each other. I mean, as long as everybody's got, like, as you say, they've all got their own slot in the market that they can all occupy, and each one can do something different, and then fanboys can rage to their heart's content, and the internet will stay interesting.
Well, I actively want to see Microsoft killed, dead. I actually want to be the person that goes in to open up Redmond's Washington offices as a soup kitchen for homeless, because Microsoft have vacated the building because they can't afford to pay the rent. So for me, you know, anything that effectively, you know, sticks a dagger in the heart of the Microsoft Corporation is great. No, I only jest.
It's really, really.
I only jest. You know, just, it doesn't need to be a dagger. Just shoot them. That'll be fine.
It's really interesting. That almost leads on to our next point, I guess. In the sense that, so something which I found really interesting in the news recently was that Adobe have released what they're calling Wallaby, which is a little application which will allow Flash developers to convert their Flash animations into an HTML5 native animation.
What's a Wallaby again? It's like a kangaroo, but smaller, I forget.
Shrunk in the wash.
Tiny little Australian beastie, I think. Yes.
But, I was trying to visualise the application in my head. If I could see what it looks like, then
the app itself looks really, well, from the demo that we saw, it looks really crude. It's just a box. You drag your app on, you mash a button, as every good converter should be, and then you wait a few seconds, and you end up with an HTML file, a massive pile of SVG files. But the best thing is, I mean, from the demo video, which you can click through on our website, it's just amazing. It's, you know, obviously some of the more advanced Flash features aren't in there. I'm sure they'll get more in there because it's kind of still at a beta stage. But the fact that you just click a button and this Flash animation, which I think we said a couple shows ago, Flash is on the way out because obviously HTML5 on the 15 million iPads or 9 to 15 million iPads.
15 million. This is 15 million iPads. Yeah.
15 million iPads. None of them run Flash. But I think it shows some really good initiative from Adobe to.
Oh yeah.
Spot where it's going before it's gone there. It's not too late for them yet. And all those people that have trained up Flash developers and all those people that have spent thousands of pounds in Flash courses, their skills are still worthwhile.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's not much of a shift. It just makes it look more, just makes it look better.
And combine that with Flex. So you've got the ability now from the skills you learned to make basic Flash animations and games, which were really crude 5 years ago. People learned these skills. You can now generate an HTML5 animation, or presumably toy at some point. That'll probably enable the UI features too. You can also generate an iPhone application, as they've got a Flash to iPhone converter. Presumably that, if it doesn't already, will convert to Android as well. And you can also generate a desktop application which runs through Flex, which in my eyes is kind of a modern Java, you know, in the sense of generating cross-platform apps. So it's really interesting where it's going.
I'm stunned that they. I'm really surprised that they've been able to do this. I mean, the open source community's view on Flash is that it's pretty poorly put together, and that it's a very kludgy piece of software. And you know, the rumor mill suggests that many of us in the open source community just simply don't believe that Adobe's actually got any documentation, and nobody really knows how it works. I think what that demonstrates from what we've seen is that actually, I think Adobe do have documentation and they do understand how it works. But it's, I know, you know, there's a whole series of projects out there that have tried to create open source Flash, Gnash and things like this, trying to reverse engineer it, and it's very, very difficult. But looking at what they've done, I actually welcome it, I really do. I think, you know, we definitely don't want to see the designers and the creative people that use Flash on the web and give us all of that richness all of a sudden being put out of business because everything moves to HTML5. Don't think that would be good for the economy or the market space. These tools that Adobe bring to the table make sure that that won't happen. But it also means that I believe that it makes the transition now to be able to take on HTML5 for the browsers to be able to embrace it and to move forward to that platform standard much easier, because we're not being hankered back by that, because in actual fact, Adobe have produced tools that would enable you to port your Flash to HTML5 or run it on the old Flash, whatever. I think it's a really positive move. And I was stunned in the demonstration to see what a tremendous rounds of applause the audience were giving, you know. I mean, obviously, loads of Flash developers there who were just overawed to see this technology at play.
Presumably, I mean, for even yourself, Jack, I mean, you're only not a massive Flash user, but the idea of setting out to make an animation in HTML5 probably scares you more than doing it in Flash.
After having seen that, yeah, I mean, I'm familiar with, like, the basics of Flash, so the idea, I mean, it's much more appealing to me at an entry level to look at that and think, oh, yeah, I've got the option of making it in Flash and then put it in HTML5. I can imagine a lot of other people thinking the same way, and they've never got far beyond the basics of the HTML5 animation. So looking at that, I expect they think, ah, it's all right, we're going to be okay. As you say, it's not going to put anybody out of business or get rid of any artists, graphic designers, anything like that. So no, keeps them in the game.
It's good. It's going to make it easy for them, isn't it? There are iOS devices going off all over the place here.
This is the dream when you've got all your calendars synced everywhere. Only I've had them on today. I usually have them on silent, so I've left them on today, and now one after another, they're all deciding to beep, and I can't get to them quick enough. I was like, iPad's off. Oh, now the phone. Oh, I don't have an iPod, luckily, but the Mac. There goes the Mac. There's the Mac. And the Windows PC will be next, but they're on silent, so it's all good.
Which explains why we're all so excited, really, about HTML5 and Flash, because, of course, all of us are all running around here with HTML5 iPads and iPhone devices, and we want the Flash goodness on our devices. So now that Adobe can give us that by converting it to HTML5, I think it's a big yay from all of us guys at random.
And it'll be great for HTML5, because it means we'll actually start seeing, you won't have to be a coder now to make your HTML5 animation.
Yeah.
Which is a massive barrier, so I think that's really good. But talking about our iPads and our iPhones...
Yeah. Nice segue move, John. Nice.
You know, getting good at this now, if I don't say so myself.
We might even be semi-professional in about 12 months.
Steady on though, right? We'll see how it goes. But I want to talk about... I'm going to kick off, if you don't mind. But I want to talk about... an app which I got for my iPad, and when it was kind of the launch app for the iPad 2, but it's backwards compatible for the iPad 1, and it's GarageBand for the iPad. GarageBand is a piece of Mac software which any Mac owner will be familiar with, because it comes pre-installed with every Mac.
In fact, it's what we record the show with, John, isn't it?
Indeed it is. It's here on the screen, and all the bars are moving along. So, so I downloaded it. It's £2.99. I thought, what, for £2.99, I'm not expecting magic. I'm expecting maybe a little toy, maybe something where I can, you know, record some vocals and then put some basic drum beat behind it or something. Just something which is you know, well, a £2.99 app. You know, we've all seen them, little image manipulators or something, £2.99. But what you actually get is essentially a whole recording studio, a plethora of virtual instruments, and something which is actually just fun to play with if you're in any way musical. I mean, I'm not a pro guitarist or anything. I just like music and I really enjoy playing with it.
Unless you're playing Guitar Hero, where I hear you are a pro hardcore guitarist.
Well, yes, I'm really slight aside, but
band?
either expert level, five star expert level,
or guitar in each hand.
What a misspent youth.
I'm really waiting for the MIDI guitar to come out, so I think that'll be the key to me learning guitar. If I can get 5-star ratings, then I'll put whatever effort in I need to get those achievements on Xbox.
I've seen some of those tools. They look good. Maybe we should talk about them at some point. So GarageBand, have you knocked anything up on it? I mean, have you...
Nothing particularly great. I mean, what's really cool about it is that you can... So not only can you record... your instruments, you can record your vocals, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You can record your instruments. Hell, let's crank it up, shall we? And just go through it quickly. So you can record your instruments, but you can also then record it, and it will kind of smart record it. So it will then convert what it's recorded into a sampled sound, which is built using MIDI keyboard, so it will convert audio to MIDI, essentially. What I did earlier is I actually plugged in my keyboard over there, and I've got a MIDI to USB adapter, and the USB plugs into the USB camera adapter, which you get with the camera pack for the iPad.
Right.
And by plugging in the keyboard through the USB adapter into the iPad,
this is getting confusing.
Yeah, right.
You can basically record your MIDI keyboard playing. So notes I was playing on the keyboard, I had the keyboard on silent, were playing out of GarageBand on the iPad, which I can then record to make my own loops, and the loops I can put together into a sequence, all on the iPad to make a 15-minute song.
Awesome. Have you got the song?
No. I didn't actually make a song. Okay. What I made didn't sound great, but...
Like Limp Bizkit, everything but the music.
But yeah, I mean, I can play with you a basic drum beat, which I put together using the kind of... This is just put together by dropping instruments on a grid. And they call it and the second it's in the change.
Oh, yeah.
That's cool.
So I was kind of thinking, this is the beginning of a backing track for a game, maybe.
Yeah.
And then you can put a couple of loops over the top. But it comes with a few hundred loops, and I mean, I can see the blatant model there. They're obviously going to sell loops later on, but I can't wait for them to start doing so.
Yeah.
That's GarageBand, and that's available on the iPad or iPad 2, and you can get that from the App Store. Just follow the link from my website. So.
For £2.99, I mean, I remember a few years back when Cubase came out, for example, for the PC, and that was somewhere in the region of about £500 a shot. This kind of tool is, similar sort of capability for £2.99.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It's an absolute bargain. I mean, you've got to get it if you like music for any sense of the way.
You'd pick it up for fun, wouldn't you, at that price.
So what have you got then, Jack? What have you got this week or this month?
What have I got? Following in the tradition of frivolous apps. Now, you can't play music with this one. This is Speedball 2 Evolution, and as anybody, any fan of the original knows, this was back on the Atari ST Amiga days. And so it's not actually a sequel to a game on the iPhone, but it was a sequel back in the day, but they kept the name because you can't say Speedball without saying 2 on the end if you're a fan. This was made by the Bitmap Brothers, who are famous for all kinds of high-quality games. And basically the setup is, if I can get past the intro movie, because we don't care about that stuff, here we go. The setup for this is, I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Rollerball.
Yes. Yeah.
But but for anybody who hasn't, it's basically like a future sports, it's kind of like American football, isn't it? It's metal ball and everybody's wearing armor and like smacking the hell out of each other in the future. And that's basically what this is. It's a top down. It looks like American football, but you can see it's all got like the sci-fi effect on all the menus. So if I go for a quick match a second. I mean, you've got many options here, and the presentation's lovely. I mean, a lot of the graphics and menus of the original have been preserved.
I love this game back in the day. I mean, it was on everything, wasn't it? Mega Drive, Atari, SNES.
Over the years, it's come back and back on many different platforms, and it's all been given a little bit of a makeover. So here we go. Our first match is Steel Fury versus Violent Desire.
Okay.
It sounds kind of dirty. But let's push play. See if we can get ourselves into a game.
I mean, this looks gorgeous. I mean, it's great to see the graphics from the old days upscaled. These are the perfect devices to see those level of graphics scaled up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it does look really crisp and quite cartoon-esque, but it's definitely still got that Amiga ST feel, hasn't it?
Very much so. I mean, all the art style has been kept. It's just been given that little bit of spit and polish. The control system is basically a D-pad. An on-screen D-pad, and then on the right you can tap the screen to throw the ball or beat up other players. And there's all sorts of other options for play, because as you can see, there's pickups on the pitch that you can get to like power up your players. And if a person takes enough damage, then a player can actually get injured and sent off the. You can score points for injuring other players.
You can score points for injuring other players. Yeah. Oh. So this is just like Speedball the movie, isn't it?
Yeah, it's proper brutal stuff. You expect James Cowan to pop in any moment and start yelling at somebody.
I mean, this is brilliant. It looks gorgeous on the iPhone 4. I mean, it's absolutely stunning, isn't it? They've
yes,
done
that's
wonders
right.
with the graphics.
I mean, I'm just playing on a 3G here, and I just love it. All the players have got their own little names, and in between games, you can buy and upgrade players, transfer them, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's got like the I'm not playing the sound effects here because they won't come up so well on the microphone. But basically, you can basically you've got lots of little incidental sound effects as well, like guy asking, like selling ice cream and things like that. So it's yeah, massive fun. At the time, it was 59p, but now I believe it's $3.99. Is that right?
It's gone up to
$3.99.
No, it's gone up to $2.99. So $1.99
now. Oh, okay.
See, I got it on the cheap price.
Yeah, you bought it when it was a bargain. Yes. Cool.
It'll be a bargain again. These aren't always oscillating price, don't they?
Yeah, precisely.
But yeah, I mean, that's a stunning game. So.
Yes, people do.
What have you brought along, Rick?
I've got an app that this is available for the iPhone or the iPad. It runs on both. I think it's actually just an iPhone app, but it seems to work really, really well on the iPad format. And I think that's because the interface has been done really quite simply and straightforward. But the app is called Magnatune, and basically, it connects to the Magnatune service, which is a it's like a kind of Creative Commons share-alike music service where artists can release their material and they get a 50-50 revenue split between them and Magnatune. And basically what this app allows you to do is to look at all kinds of different music. There is somewhere in the region of about, I don't know, 12, 15,000 songs, thousands and thousands of albums across thousands of different genres, so rock, ambient, classical, hip-hop, whatever it might be. And you can basically just choose a different genre. So like some of the tracks that you'll hear in At Random today are actually from the hip-hop genre, this Bohemian Rap CD. You have to pronounce that the right way. But basically, yeah. Pop into an album, choose an album you want to play, and it will stream it then off the net to you and let you listen to the songs. But at the same time as playing the songs, it also gives you an interface where you can look at the album artwork, you can find out more about the band, where they come from and what they're doing and so on and so forth. And the whole thing is it's just really quite a cool kind of open sourcey Spotify, I suppose, in some ways.
Yeah, as I say, it looks like a Creative Commons Spotify, only the software's actually native for the iPad, which I wish Spotify would do, and better.
Yeah. And I think, it's got, for me, it's got a bit of a feel-good factor about it because, of course, you know, it's free and, sort of free and more share-alike, etc. I wonder if it's not letting me play these now for some reason. I'll get into here. But I'm probably pressing the wrong the button.
Ah, the joys of streaming, whatever.
Ah, here we go. It. That's why, because I've got it paused. That's because I can't operate the app correctly. Yeah,
don't blame the app, people.
But but yeah, so basically what you've got here is you've got, this is Bohemian Rhapsody that you can hear here. And we've got the artwork here, which is that this cartoon sort of album for the band cover. But then this little, in the corner here, you've got like a little leaf, like a sort of turned up leaf. And when you press that, it takes you over then and gives you a biog. So you can see here the band Marginal Profits, gives you a picture of the band and a whole load of biog about them, where they're from, what albums they've released and so on and so forth. And I really like that because you can kind of have the music playing like you can hear right now and at the same time have a dig around and see what's going on there.
That's really cool because those small sort of indie bands almost, they're the ones you want to read about as well, aren't they? They're the ones that's quite interesting to read about where they've come from and their background as well, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I like about it. And I think if you want to discover new music, I think Magnatune offers a great service in this. And because they vet the musicians beforehand, there doesn't tend to be like, you know, half-baked rubbish. I would say it's good quality music that's been well produced, you know, it's studio level production. The albums are all hanging together. So it's up to the kind of level you would expect to get on iTunes, but it's just got some, feel good things about it.
See all over their marketing, they just say, "We are not evil," right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We're not evil.
That makes me suspicious.
Yeah, they've got a website as well, magnatune.com, where you can find out a lot more about this. And it tells you all about it, and you can, in fact, you don't have to have an iPhone or an iPad because you can stream the music from magnatune.com as well, or any device. So I think that's quite cool.
And that was free, you say?
Yeah, this is a free app. The music is freely available to you. You do get some You know, you're listening to Magnitune Interruptions, or this was CD track 3 from Magnitune from time to time. But you can buy a subscription to Magnitune, costs about $15 a month, and that gives you access to none of that, so you don't get any interruptions, and you can freely download any one of the 12,000 albums or tracks from Magnitune, keep them on your hard drive, whatever you want to do with them, just for that small fee. So that's real good, real good as well. It's really cheap. So yeah, that's it. And maybe we could pop a track of this onto the end of the show.
Definitely, that'd be really good. I want
to have a listen to that.
So.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's Magnitune, and that's available on the App Store as well right now.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Brilliant. So I think it's time for a word from our sponsors.
So we've got a legit sponsor for this show and going forward. What we want to do is we want to try to encourage our listeners to interact with us. Send us some emails, show@random.org. Give us your ideas, give us some feedback. What we've got our sponsors, Abazander, you can find out more about them at abazander.com, their website. Basically, they've got some really cool mouse mats on offer. Which have got some really nice branded logo stuff on them. And hey, guys, you know, they're mouse mats and they're free. So email us, give us your feedback. You'll get a response from us asking you to send us a mailing address where we can send it. And if you interact with us, send us an email. We'll send you a free mouse mat in the post. And that's courtesy of Abazander.com. So, hey, thanks, Abazander. Really cool.
Oh, fantastic. That's very kind of them. And obviously, the real prize is you get a response from us three too.
You know it. Safe.
Hell, I'm going to send us an email.
Talking about emails, our friend Jerry's back. Sent us another soundbite. John, press the button.
Good old Jerry, I love him.
Hiya, lads, it's Jerry Mank Techie. Coming back at you. Great show, loves it. I love it, lads. I've just got to deliver this one to you. I've just been looking at an email from one of our clients, right? We obviously delivering application services. I got an email in from one of our clients asking if they could tidy one of their systems up. Comes from operations manager, who said, could we sort their systems out? They wanted a reduction on the number of email accounts, give us specific usernames for the accounts that they wanted to keep, told us to delete everything else, get rid of it, sort it all out so we were keeping costs down, and that we were not to take any further instructions from anybody else inside the company except for corporate director and operations director. Email comes in last week, some day, 3 or 4 days ago. So we put that through to support, no trouble at all, get it sorted. Delete all the mail accounts, clear everything down, sort it all out, set up the new billing, get it all sorted, banging, send out an email yesterday, no problem, everybody's happy, totally wicked. Email comes in today from operations manager, dear support, can you confirm that such and such a person's email address that was not on list, can you confirm that it's still in existence? IT have pointed out to us that they had special configurations put in place for 4 or 5 accounts to provide a workaround for their old antiquated email system that couldn't look at like subfolders inside an IMAP mailbox, so it could only basically pull things in via POP, so we had to create a sim-linked POP account from the IMAP sent account to allow it to create rounds, so creating these two accounts for them to go in. And can we please confirm that those accounts are active? No! Of course we can't confirm that they're active. Are you completely bloody stupid or what? Of course we can't. We just bloody deleted them. You sent us an email telling us to get rid of them all. So that's what we did. You're totally nipping me Sweden, man. So I've had to send an email back to them now telling them, no, they're gone. Deleted, just like you said. That's what you wanted to happen. Anyway, so, you know, now what's going to happen is, of course, they're going to want to reinstate them all, aren't they? And we'll have to invoice them for that. Then they'll start complaining. Oh, no, we don't want to pay for that. Well, you're going to have to pay for it. Why? Because you're a muppet. And you're doing me Sweden, man. You're mashing me melon. Now cut it out and get yourself organised, all right? Jerry Manktecki, signing out. See you, lads.
He's absolutely mad as a mad as anything.
Some life lessons there from Jerry.
But how many times have you seen that? How many times have you seen, you know, where the customers are doing that to you and asking you to do things that they then want undone? I've seen it loads. It's
the crazy. Biggest one back in the day, not so much now because most emails stored server side, But you go to someone's house, usually a friend back then, I wasn't old enough to have clients, and they'd say, can you fix the computer? Yep, we'll just reinstall Windows. Have you backed everything up? Yeah. Everything. Have you backed everything up? Ooh, not my bookmarks. All right, so you go through the process, you back up the final few things, and then you format it, and the first thing that they always did, when you turn it back on again, they go, oh, just curious, where's my email gone? Well, funnily, when I said we're deleting everything off your computer, that included your email.
Oddly enough.
What? But I need it. You shouldn't have pushed the bloody format button then, should you?
Did you not tell him to just go outside and have a look in the bin?
Luckily, with server-side email now, that's a problem of the past, but many times.
It isn't a thing of the past at all. Yes, there's server-side email, but how many times do we see people who've lost it all? I've just reinstalled it. Yeah, but I thought it was server-side. Yes, but you've got a POP connection.
Yeah, you set the wrong connection.
All gone. All gone.
Oh, dear.
But never mind, you know, life goes on. Nobody's going to die, are they?
So next up, I've got a bit of a treat here for Code Monkey.
Yeah.
And this tip actually came from one of our listeners who was listening to the last show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a bit of rapport going back and forth. And he said he'd like to see some Android app reviews, obviously, because we all own iPhones and iPads. We've generally been reviewing iPhone and iPad apps, but...
What's Android?
Yeah, what's Android? So obviously, with all the new tablets coming out as well, I mean, that would be really interesting. And I think at some point, I'm probably going to have to geek out and complete my tech collection by getting an Android tablet. I don't think the wife will appreciate that, but, you know...
I'm in the same boat, we can both share our dinner in the doghouse together.
With our shiny Android tablets.
Yeah, you know it, that's right. Yeah, wife's not speaking to us, but that doesn't matter because I've got IRC.
but in the interim, while unfortunately I haven't made that brave step yet, so our caller suggested maybe installing Android, the x86 version, in VirtualBox. Because obviously Android is an open source operating system.
Based on Linux. Uses Linux kernel.
which means that while it's typically compiled for ARM, it doesn't need to be compiled for ARM.
Mm-hmm.
So an active group have actually made a distro, the Android x86 distro.
That sounds awesome.
So that you can install Android straight onto a partition on your PC.
Straight onto onto your PC, like, that's impressive.
But obviously I didn't want to kind of go through the hassle of dual booting and having to reformat my hard drive. So I used the joys of VirtualBox, another fantastic piece of open source software. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that we can just install Android x86 in VirtualBox and play with it.
That sounds really cool. So... got a demo that we can have a look at them.
Hmm.
So, I mean, obviously the VirtualBox screen there makes a lot of sense. Any problems with getting the thing running, John, or any difficulties? Or was it a straightforward install to get that booted? Did it just come as a playable VM, or did you actually have to go through an installation process on the virtual machine?
Went through an install process. It was... easier than installing Linux.
You just click the button yes.
Because obviously...
In Linux these days, there's only three questions. It's so simple.
There's no packages to pick or anything like that.
Yeah.
So you pretty much just go, I would like to install... And you can actually... So Android x86, the team, release a bunch of ISO files for different platforms. So there is an EPC version, which will run better on netbooks than it will on a more powerful PC.
Okay.
But the one that I use, which is, I think it's the sort of standard one, there's a tutorial which we've linked to from our blog, from the show notes, and it took you through all the steps. But actually, when you look through them, it's pretty much add a new VirtualBox machine, add a hard drive, put the disk in, and you can either run it live, so no install required.
Okay.
Which you could obviously just run live if you put it in your PC and reboot it.
In your CD player,
Or you can install it to a partition, and then it just went, it brought up FDisk. I created a partition, hit enter, and then that's it. And you end up with this, and here you go. You know, you can... I mean, the biggest problem with it, so what's quite cool, it's really, you know, funky to play around with Android, and it's just sitting here in a window, and you can sort of never really play with an Android device properly before, so
yeah.
All the interface things are like, ooh, that's quite cool. So this little bar drags down from the top, and if you mash escape, then it acts as a back button, so you can go back to the home screen.
Okay.
Now, it comes with an App Store app, which lets you download apps, because it can't connect to the Android marketplace. Because only registered devices can do that. So that's kind of the downside, I think, of running it here. And while the App Store gives you access to a massive variety of apps, a couple of thousand, many of them don't work. Because apps on the Android, as far as I'm aware, apps on the Android devices run in the Java virtual machine, which means a large proportion of them will work. But then some of them will use ARM-specific native code.
Okay.
And if it's using that, obviously, because it's recompiled for x86, then those apps will choke at the moment. So.
But that might be... And, I mean, have you had an opportunity to be able to assess what the performance of it is like at all? I'm just thinking, you mentioned about, like, the EPC and things like that. I mean, I've got a little EPC in the drawer at home that, you know, could be given a new lease of life, and it might be really interesting to load Android onto it to, you know, turn it into an Android device. A little Android laptop be quite cool.
I mean, sitting here in the VirtualBox, its performance seems good. The graphical performance is a little bit sort of ropey, a bit slow, but I think that's because VirtualBox isn't very good at using the kind of frame buffer.
Okay.
You know, so it doesn't emulate the frame buffer all that efficiently. So I don't think it's actually down to the emulation speed. And obviously, it's not emulating at all. So, I mean, if you were to just put the live CD in, I haven't tried this, and run it, it should run really smoothly. I mean, you essentially have in my case, a quad-core Android device, you know, because it's running Android with your hardware.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the performance, from what I've seen of it, has been more than adequate. And, I mean, the other option is you could install it. Presumably, you can probably install Android in something, say, QEMU, which would emulate an ARM chip.
Yep.
If you then wanted to have access to those other apps. But that's obviously not quite the discussion here. But, I mean, yeah, it's really fun to play with. And if you're getting into Android app development, or if you want to get a bit more hands-on with the underlying OS, it's a really good way to get involved.
Or if you just want to play around with some of the different cool apps that are on there and different things that, you know, which is a kind of different experience from Apple without having to go and buy a device. You know, you can just download these two things straight onto your Windows PC or your Linux desktop or whatever. And we've put links for this in the show notes, haven't we, for VirtualBox and the Android thing and all of that kind of everything you need to know is up there.
Yeah, just head over to www.atrandom.org and then you can click through, and the tutorial is really straightforward to follow. But it's even easier if you just burn the ISO, whack it in the drive and reboot your computer. So,
yeah.
And you can be playing with your own little Android device. And like you say, I think there's possible real value in actually putting it on an old netbook that you don't use anymore.
Well, I'm definitely going to try it in a VM because I've got Virtual Machine running on my Linux laptop anyway, and it's got oodles of power there. And I've got VirtualBox installed, so I just literally download the ISOs onto the hard drive and just boot from them. So I don't need to burn any disks or anything else, just fire straight into it. So I'm definitely going to do that.
I suspect with your EPC, you could probably burn it to a flash drive and boot off the flash drive.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
A little four gig flash stick will actually be more than enough to hold all of Android.
Yeah, create a startup disk, a little startup USB disk.
I mean,
I'm going to try that, John, and see whether I can... Because my EPC's actually given up the ghost. I think there might be a problem with the SSD chip and the SSD drive inside it. But I suspect I could probably get it to boot up off a flash disk, and then maybe I could maybe even try to install it onto a little SD card or something. And
yeah, all of
a
sudden, yeah.
What was a broken device is now up and working. If I get some time, I'll try that, and maybe I'll bring something back next time.
They were really cool to play with it on the next show. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
That'd be awesome. That's Android x86 2.2 running in VirtualBox, and just head over to atrandom.org to find out more. So that brings us on to Deep Thought.
Yeah. Okay.
Yay.
So for Deep Thought, I've brought something a little bit We've talked about it a lot. We've probably even mentioned it on a couple of the shows in passing. Have, yeah. But something which is I find really, really interesting is the pure power that you get nowadays on graphics cards, which you can buy and put in your home PC. So I'm going to throw the term CUDA computing up there. And that's kind of the NVIDIA-specific language for using your graphics cards for things other than graphics. Or okay. for things other than
is
real
CUDA an graphics. Acronym for something, or is it just a name they've made up to sort of, like, because it sounds a bit cool?
You know, it probably is. And but while reading all of the CUDA API information, I did not read to see if it was an acronym.
Well, maybe that's one for the guys to out there to have a look. Maybe if you know what CUDA stands for, drop us an email and we'll give you a mouse mat.
All right.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. But so I thought, it would be wrong not to start off with some statistics, I guess. So if we just look at the GeForce GTX 580, for instance. Now, this is one of the high-end modern GeForce graphics cards. And you're probably looking at about £350 to buy one of these for your home computer. So it's the high end, obviously. You can get ones three quarters as powerful for half the price. But for £350, which is attainable for a home user, mm-hmm. and pretty much a pittance for a business who, say, might want to plug three of them together, because they run in SLI, so you can run up the three of them in a motherboard. But just one GeForce 580 gives you 512 processing cores.
Okay.
And that's running on a graphics clock at 800 megahertz. If you just sort of, it takes a second to think about that, but you essentially have 512 mathematical processing cores, each running at a gigahertz.
Wow. And then you can multiply that by three.
Yeah.
So you can have your own mini supercomputer in some ways. But what can you do on those cores then? I mean, I know obviously it's a graphics card, isn't it, for making graphics things, but what kind of stuff can you do on those cores?
I mean, obviously, they're made for gamers. I mean, that's like the initial, if you had to say what's its main use, it's for games. And you can just see by something like Crysis 2, which I know we've all seen here, you can now run that at 1080p, which is actually 2 million pixels. Draw those 2 million pixels 60 times a second, not once but twice, so that you can play it in stereoscopic 3D.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually have it pushing out 120 images a second, so you can see it in stereoscopic 3D. And that's attainable on the mid-range cards. So there isn't really much gaming used for the high-end cards. I mean, obviously some games, Crysis 1 kind of ekes a bit more out of it. But what I find really interesting are the alternative uses. So probably the most user-friendly, sort of home-friendly example is just encoding video. And there are some pieces of software out there now which let you encode your video on the graphics card. So essentially it will send all the data to the graphics card and then run an MP4 encoder using those cores and then just feed the encoded video back onto your hard drive.
Okay, that sounds quite interesting. I mean, I do make screencasts and things like that, and one of the things that takes time in Kden Live is actually making the output file. When you tell it to render it, off it goes, and you know, and sometimes it can take us sometimes as long or longer than the actual video. I might have a clip of of 10 minutes clip, and it'll take it good long while to render that out. So I could pass that to graphics cores and it'd do it a lot faster.
Yeah, I mean, I use a media encoder on my desktop, and I'm just running the GTX 260, which is maybe a year and a half old now, and not the high-end card. And I can encode a 28-minute episode of Big Bang Theory for my iPad, and it encoded in about 4 minutes.
Well,
it's 3.5 to 4.5 minutes.
That's cool.
So you're talking almost 10 times real time. Now, if I encoded it on my quad core, we're talking probably about 20 minutes, 25 minutes. So it's pretty much real time. Now, the other huge benefit is that while I'm encoding it on the graphics card, it's only using up one of my four cores, and all that core is doing is sending stuff to the graphics card and collecting it. Whereas if I were encoding it on the CPU, my computer would be grinding to a halt, and I'd, you know.
Yeah, and be working really hard to do that job.
If I'm trying to load up Access in the background to do some database work, it wouldn't be happy. Whereas it's just piping it all to the GPU on the graphics card, and I can just kick back and continue using my PC as if it was doing nothing.
So, now obviously you've got a strong background in mathematics, so let's dig in here a little bit deeper. That's the whole point of deep thought. I want to ask you some questions just really about how this is being used in a gaming environment. Now, we were talking earlier on about how modelling meshes are used effectively to create game scenes and game environments. Just give me a little bit of background, John, about the basics of that. So if I'm constructing a 3D scene, perhaps of a racing game or something like that, what are the basic things that go into making that up that the graphics card takes care of from a gaming perspective?
Yeah, so it's probably best if I'll keep this really short. If we go back a little bit in history and we go back to Quake.
Yeah,
if you think of something like Quake, it's a bit easier to visualise what's going on because the model's in Quake. So if you just think about the Quake guy on a white background and you wanted to draw him from a mathematical point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the guy is essentially made up of, we've all seen the sort of the chunky square polygons.
Yes.
Now, a polygon is obviously a kind of shape in 3D space. And you can describe it by just putting the reference points as if you're looking on a map.
Almost like triangles often, aren't they? Am I right?
Yeah, they always break them down into triangles before they draw them.
Yeah.
So you can basically, for a triangle that's in 3D space, you can define the three points that are the corners of that triangle.
Yeah.
And that's enough information for you to draw a triangle in space. So on a page, it all have like a Z value of zero because they're all flat.
Yes.
But obviously, so that is if you're drawing a triangle on a map.
So if this was a 2D scene, it would be like, so you'd have X and Y positions plotting where they all sit, but nothing on the Z because it's just all sitting flat.
Yeah, so then you bring that into 3D and then you have to start considering, then obviously you sort of get these, like the Quake guy. So there's essentially two parts to a 3D scene, specifically in games. Obviously you can get more advanced than in 3D modelers. And that is the mesh itself. And you've almost undoubtedly seen the wireframe mesh drawn in some kind of films, maybe sometimes.
If you go way back when to 8-bit micros and you played like games like Star Glider and Elite and things like that, they were wireframe models.
Yeah. That's all you saw was the mesh.
Correct.
And that's essentially, so that's the first stage of like the data that you need to make a 3D scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the second bit is literally kind of just wrapping 2D graphics over the top of that, like a skin. And then we call those the textures.
Okay.
So each one of those triangles, on the Quake guy, there are, say, 560, but nowadays you might have 10,000-20,000 in the character model. Each one of those triangles literally just maps to a certain part of a texture. So you might say this triangle is in the top right corner of this texture.
Okay.
And then the graphics card. So what you do is you've got a selection of numbers, which are the points for all the triangles.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a selection of image files, which are the textures. Now, you load up all the textures onto the graphics card before you start, and the mesh data. So all those vertices, all those images, you push them all through to the graphics card so that the time to get them there and back is reasonably slow. But once they're there, I mean, if we look at this sort of GeForce 580, it can move 192 gigabytes of data around its own internal memory a second.
Okay.
So that's kind of your entire hard drive.
192 gigabytes?
Yeah.
Holy smoke. Right, that's a lot.
But that's what it's going to be using when it converts those images and those points into a 2D representation
mm-hmm.
of that data. Because obviously you're only ever going to be looking at it through a window. So it takes all of those points that you've given it, and all those textures, and then it runs a little program which goes through that, picks out the little bit which you can see in your viewport, and then colours it in for you. Essentially, that's what it's doing. So you've given it enough information for the entire scene that you're looking at. And then you've given it all the textures. But then what your graphics card has to do is just chop out the little bit you can see. And that's the first thing it does. It sort of transforms the dots and the triangles to your screen.
So this is the bit you can see being the window that your viewing portal of the screen.
Yeah.
So for example, the Quake Arena, when you're in it, it's obviously much bigger, isn't it? You can turn to the left, turn to the right. But any moment in time, you've just got what you can see in front of you on your screen. So it's that section. But the rest of the game environment, all the maths and points and polygons and textures for that, still loaded into the main memory. But yep. we're just passing. Now that is being passed to what they call a frame buffer, isn't it? Is that right? Mm. And the frame buffer, is that on the car, on the graphics card as well? And the screen's plugging into that.
Yeah, yeah, essentially. So what you're doing is you're actually kind of building your image up in memory a bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that's ready, you can push it out as a frame down the cable to the to the monitor. So.
Yeah, okay.
So essentially you chop out the bit of the world you can see, then you colour it in with the textures. What's really interesting is just that the pure power of what these cars can do now. One of the big features you hear with DirectX 11 is this tessellation feature. So, where with the Quake guy, you can blatantly see the triangles that make up his arms.
Yeah.
And now, the way we've traditionally made that better is by just making more and more triangles. But there's still going to be a point when you zoom in, and it becomes a triangle. Now, that might be on your fingernail or the tooth of a character or something, but there's a point where it becomes a simple shape.
Okay.
Now, what the new graphics cards do is they actually... So, once that first step is gone... and you've got the bit of the scene that you're looking at, what it does is then it takes the polygons which are remaining in the scene and then adds extra detail to them by splitting them up and then transforming them using either some programming or, say, a little image which describes the height of all the bits of that tooth.
So could you visualise that in the looking at the wireframe? So let's say we looked at, you know, four triangles connected together in the wireframe. And what we would do is then split each one of those triangles up into, say, 100 triangles each.
Yeah.
So then you'd have 400 triangles in the wireframe. But we don't need to pass that to the graphics card. We can pass it the first four and tell it to do a tessellation.
Yeah.
And then it'll divide it up based on some algorithms and parameters that we give it as to how that division should take place. Is that...
Precisely, yeah. Yeah. So you're looking at just the guy's tooth. And because it says, well, there's only four polygons on the screen now, four triangles that you've got, we can draw... 100,000. So let's split these four up into 1,000. Now, obviously, it's still going to look the same. It's just going to draw it 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
So then what it does is it either, if it's something like a tooth and you're zoomed right in, you might just randomly move those pixels around a little bit to give it some shape.
Because
when you zoom right into a tooth, obviously, it's not exactly smooth. You've got the sort of up and down bumps. But you could also give it some more information, or you could tell it to intelligently calculate where those extra... triangles go, and that gives it some more shape and allows you to have better reflections and shadows.
Okay.
So, but that's all done on the graphics card, so you just give it a square tooth and then some rules how to make that more detailed, and it will do that, but only when you're looking at the tooth. So when you zoom out again, you're looking at the frame, that tooth just goes back to being four triangles, so they can draw them quickly and get over it.
So basically, because we've got that tessellation ability in there, then what we're able to do is, where before we would have zoomed in on our little Quake Man and it would have just gone to triangles, and every time we stop the zoom, the tessellation feature just smooths everything out, runs some little algorithms to make it all look nice and smooth around. You go zooming in again, and it'll do the same thing again. So as you, it's a little bit like watching, a bit like Google Earth. You start out, and you zoom in, and then you can see Google Earth sort of go... bring the resolution in and render it till it's crisp and then zoom in again, but it's doing it like instantaneously and in much higher detail. But of course what you end up with is realistic looking graphics that look really real, irrespective of where your kind of camera angle is and so on and so forth, because it's all being computed on the fly by all of those cores.
So I mean that's really clever, and that's just a glimpse into the power of these graphics cards. And I'll really briefly just touch on some of the other uses. But I mean, there are obvious uses like video encoding, like we were saying. And if you've got a whole stack of these cards, you can just knock out the video. But you can also do advanced graphics work, like ray tracing, which is less like graphics and more like mathematics, to be honest.
Okay.
Because at that level, you're not doing maths in the same polygon sense. You're kind of drawing rays of light across the scene.
So you're using physics algorithms to effectively define how photons of light would move around a scene and then how they'd interact with the objects, and then calculating those to create photorealistic images.
Precisely. And traditionally, yep. I mean, traditionally they would take hours. When I first got my copy of 3DS Max right back in the day, I would set up my scene carefully and perfectly. I'd hit render and I'd come back the morning after and it'd still be going. Yeah, we're talking 12 to 16 hours. And they were reasonably simple scenes, but I'd put the ray tracing on to do all the reflections and lighting. But I mean, we saw a demo earlier, and this is the demo that comes with the GeForce 400 card. So if you have one of those cards, you can actually run it yourself at home. We saw a video of it, and that's ray tracing a car. And it's not quite in real time, but it's close.
And you just get that kind of like sort of fizzy, grainy bit. A little bit like the sort of the resolution smoothing that goes on in Google Earth. You could see the Ferrari, and then you'd see it just smooth, and then go to really shiny, polished, lovely car. Now that's something that years ago, as you're saying, would have taken 24 hours, 48 hours to render, and now it's almost producing that in real time. You know, in the few seconds it takes to produce that.
And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if. I mean, it'd be a great gimmick if they brought out something like Shrek real time. So you could pan the camera around and watch it from any angle you wanted.
Wow, yeah, yeah.
And something like Shrek.
A scene from Shrek, and then being able to just move around it and as you do, you know. Or you're talking about with the characters actually animated in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the film maybe Shrek moving. Is a tiny bit too advanced, but something a couple of years before that. I suspect we could already just push that out on one of the high-end home graphics cards. And as the film is playing out, you can move the camera around.
I mean, one of the things I've been playing around with recently and looking at is Blender, the open source program. And I'd probably talk about that another time on one of these shows. But one of the things that's really that takes the most amount of time there is rendering up the animation afterwards, because you create all of these scenes that have to be played 25 scenes at a time to create your animated character walking around. And it takes tons of compute power to render each one of those scenes one after another after another. If you had a machine with a couple of these cards in it, is that capable of being, can you hand it that kind of work? So effectively create like a render farm for something like Maya or Blender or something, is that possible?
I mean, definitely. I mean, I don't know if Blender specifically supports the CUDA cards, but okay. I mean, that's exactly the sort of application where you might even be able to take something that NVIDIA sell a tower PC, and I think it actually has a slightly different cards to the one we're looking at here. But I think you can stack 8 of them up in one computer,
right?
To give you over 2,000 cores of processing power. And that box only costs about $2,500. So it's actually what my friend paid for a PC probably about 10 years ago, which had a Pentium in it. And that was a big thing at the time. It got a Pentium processor and a Voodoo graphics card, so it actually had a 3D card. And he probably paid about $1,600 for that. So now you can, for the equivalent price, you can buy 2,000 processing cores.
I think what's exciting about it is the fact that that you've got all that power for games, for graphics, for doing all that kind of stuff, and all that good stuff that goes with that. But I just love the idea of being able to access those cores for high CPU intensive jobs. You know, for example, one of the things I'd love to try playing around with it is how quickly could it compile Gentoo, something like that. If it's capable of running, could you run a compiler on it and then allow it to do all of that across the cores?
I mean, the instruction set's a bit limited. I mean, I'm not saying it'd be impossible. It'd be a bit of a challenge, I think, to sort of bend it to that kind of... I think it'd be a challenge to harness the power of the cores in a task like that.
In that context, okay.
So possibly, it could be possible to kind of throw out the different apps and then compile them in parallel. But one of the biggest tasks, challenges in using the GPU for this sort of thing is just paralyzing your job. So something where you're drawing a picture is perfect because you can just take each pixel individually or each vertex first and then each pixel, just go through each one and you can be rendering one. Without caring what the other one is.
Because the scene all gets built up again, so all 400 processors can go away, do their bit, post them back together again. Of course, they all take a different position in the frame buffer anyway.
Yeah.
So they can all just load themselves up into wherever they've got to go. So that works. Whereas when you're compiling a piece of software, of course, the software itself is linear in some ways. So the kind of compilation route needs to be linear. So,
but presumably, for things like cracking encryption and things, it would probably be lightning fast.
Hundreds of little brute force attacks. Yeah, so that'd be really interesting as well. I mean, one of those NVIDIA things. I wonder. I mean, they talk about how long it takes to, break 128 bit 256. So that'd be really interesting to play with as well.
I mean, if you look at, it's gone a bit now. I think we should wrap this up. But I mean, if you look at the CUDA community showcase, there's 1,200 examples on the NVIDIA website of where it's been used. And then, and you can really quickly see here just some of the speed increases some of these apps have got. So, I mean, you'd expect, if something's using it well, you'd expect a speed increase of maybe, obviously, 100 times, 1.4. But, I mean, some apps here have got a 1,700 times increase because they can just throw it all into the graphics card.
And let it super fast
memory and just wait for it to happen.
Well, all of this is in the show notes, and obviously, you know, there's loads of information there that are backing that up. I wanted to dig into this, to be honest with you, because 30 years ago, when 8-bit micros were out, I played around with graphics, played around with a little bit of modelling and stuff, and then didn't do anything with it. The technology's moved on so much that asking you those questions gave me a chance to sort of see where it is today. And hopefully, maybe that answered some of the questions for some of the listeners. But I think at the end of the day, that's really where we should bring it to a close for this week. So my name is Rick Timmis, and the show is At Random. Do get in touch with us. Remember that Abrazander have given us those mouse mats that we'll send out to you guys and girls out there. So show@random.org. If you want us to talk about something, look at anything, let us know. Give us some feedback. What do you think? I'm going to say cheerio tonight and hand over to John.
That's all from me. So good night and thank you.
Jackson.
Don't have nightmares.
Show us that you